percent of that $1 trillion is $10 billion. We're a rich state, and we have to have a government that treats our state as a rich state and does so by taxing the wealthiest, by mitigating their wealth, and by creating the basis for a social service, human service, public service program that employs everyone who needs a job.
Yes, and I want to remind listeners that Illinois is usually one of the five worst, that is, the five most regressive tax states in the country. That is, one of the five worst on lower income people in this country, along with Washington State, two usually liberal states. You know, I think it's weird. You know, it's like we're the Mississippi of the Midwest or something.
Yeah, and also I think we get into, besides just, alleviating the suffering of working people in general, there's also the empowerment. Where does the Green Party, stand on that?
Well, I just, what Bill just read, I mean, what I've written, I mean, there's so many aspects of the Green Party platform, of the 10 key values that have to do with local control and genuinely democratic values and reforming this winner-take-all, political, electoral system, and really emphasizing local control, local food systems, really being honest about the things that, it isn't all about what benefits this district or that district. Being honest about biofuels, even though we're in the heart of biofuel country, being honest about things like that. But about the problems with things like that. But still, just really realizing that things can be done at the local level. We have an economy at the local level. We have taxation powers at the local level. We have enormous wealth in Champaign County, and we tend to think, well, if you can't do it at the federal level, you can't do it at any level. You were talking about the federal level before, Bill, and yes, they have the power to go into debt. They have the power to create currency. So that puts the states and local units of government
at disadvantage.
Yes, but we've got plenty of wealth here, and we have to figure out ways we can tax that wealth. And of course, wealthy people will say, well, we're going to move somewhere else. You know, we can do this at various levels. We can have single-payer health care at the state level. You know, we can do all kinds of things at state and local levels that would be reforms that would go beyond
My kind of idea behind that is, one of our big problems is that capitalism, the theory of it's not working the way it's supposed to, whereas when you allow all these wealthy people to get all of this money, then they will invest it and do something with it. Well, all they're doing is just sitting on it, or they're buying back their own stocks. And I'm just saying, what the hell, man? See, people, if you talk about pumping money out, then they'll start worrying about inflation. But that's what I'm saying. We could have bailouts at least of our public employees' pension plans without adding to inflation. And I, even though I do like the idea of taxing more, I mean, that needs to be done, obviously, too.
Well, we need a wealth tax. We need a wealth tax because that's where the money is. And it's at that $1 trillion at the 1%. They don't exactly sit on it, but they do that. That $1 trillion needs to be used to help the real economy of this state.
That's
the
what
real,
I'm saying.
The real flows.
Right, exactly.
And we've stifled that.
That's the point, though. Remember, there's a difference between what capitalists want to do and what capitalists tell people they want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the greatest things that Marx was trying to get across, was that capitalism, the worst part about it is that it works really well, because the job of it is to make profit off the exploitation of labor at the cheapest cost of labor. That's what it does. And to get people to buy into it, you tell them, we're going to invest it back into the community. We're going to invest it back into jobs, into food.
And you could be a millionaire yourself someday if you work hard.
So again, that propaganda piece is very important when we talk about it. But again, the worst part about how capitalism is at its base is that it works, but it only works for the people who own
the vast amounts of wealth.
Means of production.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
That's always been the case. And what's a little bit different now is that along with with destroying or making working class people miserable and keeping people out of work and in poverty. We have, I think, two phenomena that add into this, that add into the crisis mentality. One, which we've already mentioned, the environmental crisis that needs to be dealt with in short order and can't be dealt with within the context of this neoliberal framework. We're not going to market our way. We're not going to profit our way out of climate change. But the other thing is the fact that we have an excess population that our racist system has decided to put into prison, and that is creating a crisis, a racial crisis, a general crisis in other ways, and bringing a lot of these problems to the fore also. So I think we can look at those two things and perhaps other things as kind of aspects that are creating a crisis mentality in which people will have to really look beyond this neoliberal system that just isn't working, that is sort of is just breaking under its own weight.
Okay, we're going to take a real quick music break, and we're going to be right back. You listen to the World Labor Hour on the Party Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign. Yes, of course, that was Bob Marley's classic, Get Up, Stand Up for Your Rights. And I really should play that song more often, but thinking of Labor Day and stuff, I had to get that one in there. So, Gus, so I heard there's a new chapter that's formed in Champaign-Urbana, Black Lives Matter?
Yes, it was just established last week, at the beginning of last week, the National Organization granted the charter.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe now... And again, I'm not going to give you data because I believe it's 56 56 local charters in the country right now. And so I think we would be number 57. That number may be wrong, but I think it's around in that range though. So yes, so we do have a Champaign-Urbana Black Lives Matter charter now, mm-hmm. that is going to get started really soon.
So. Even though there's been actions in support of Black Lives Matter in the past, including that huge demonstration outside the county courthouse and back in, when was that? Back in the winter.
Yeah, that was that. It was negative. It was negative like 10 that day.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, but there was like 300-400 some people out there, you know, and shut down Main Street right there in front of the sheriff's department for a while. And
that's what we're going to get into is just looking at, you know, not necessarily criticizing what Black Lives Matter is doing right now,
mm-hmm.
but there needs to be some type of evaluation.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of problems that go into when you have a social movement.
Yes.
And one of the things that a lot of people argue about in terms of social movement is objective.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a particular objective that you're fighting for, and you have to be clear and tight on not only the strategy, but how you're going to get to that objective and what comes from it. My biggest criticism of Black Lives Matter, and this came through a lot when they approached Hillary Clinton, was that their objective and their issue was totally unclear. They just came at her and just were just talking very generalized about the issue of black people in the mm-hmm. country. What did they expect her to say?
Yeah.
Of course.
Hey, guys. Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask you about something about, and along with these interruptions of other speakers besides you and me interrupting you now. Is there an organization here with some structure and some kind of decision making on when these things should occur and how they should occur? Like who talks to Hillary Clinton and what they talk to her about? Is that more of a group thing?
That's a good question. That's what we're trying to get to the bottom of is what is the methodology behind Black Lives Matter and what's their ultimate end goal? I mean, that's what I was talking with David about. Are they reformers or are they restructurers, revolutionaries? You know, because like I said, they haven't been very clear in their message. And if you're going to do something like a social movement type aspect, and as big as this thing has gotten, because I don't even know if Black Lives Matter thought they were going to get as big as they are right now back when they first started.
I remember hearing some things like this back around 2011. Another movement that wasn't too clear on what they were doing.
Oh, the Occupy movement.
Occupy movement. Yeah, so. But
that was kind of their point, was to not be clear.
And we saw what happened with that. There's never, and that's historical. You can't have a social movement without a clear objective that has ever been successful. But Dave has got some stuff he's going to talk about.
Yeah, this is from Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. And Glenn Ford used to be, in fact, the people with Black Agenda Report, a lot of them are former Black Panthers. So they went through a lot of this back in the 60s.
Exactly.
You know, and they've learned some lessons, some hard lessons, too. Mm-hmm. This is a report called Black Lives Matter Hurts Democratic Party's Feelings. He said the Democrats that pushed their party's national committee, the DNC, to endorse Black Lives Matter organization and its three co-founders by name told reporters they felt blindsided when Black Lives Matter leadership refused to endorse them back. And anyway, I guess it goes on to say that Monday, Black Lives Matter leaders issued the following response. It deserves a careful reading. They basically state a resolution signaling the Democratic National Committee's endorsement that Black Lives Matter in no way implies an endorsement of the DNC, Democratic National Committee, by the Black Lives Matter Network, nor was it done in consultation with us. And anyway, this goes on to say that the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, have historically attempted to control or contain black people's efforts to liberate themselves. And true change requires real struggle, and that struggle will be in the streets and led by the people, but not by a political party. But anyway, it goes on here with Glenn Ford saying, while the Black Lives Matter Network applauds political change towards making the world safer for black people, our only endorsement goes to the protest movement we built together with black people nationwide. And anyway, he's going on to say basically that they are, they've done a lot of great things here, but that they don't have a specific set of demands.
Exactly.
Like you're saying there.
That's the whole point. What they've done is, see, we're at the point, if anybody gets a chance to read Robin D.G. Kelly's book, Race Rebels, he has one of the most excellent analyses of what's happening with social movements in America. At the stage that Black Lives Matter is at right now is what we call the infra-political stage, infra-politics. There's a lot of fervor, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of consciousness raising, but there's no coalescing into an objective or some type of movement, some type of demand. That's the point that they just can't seem to get over. It's been over a year now since Black Lives Matter was officially formed, and there still hasn't been an objective objective that has been set by the group. And what I mean by that is you have to have some type of political ideology. And I'm not talking about electoral politics. I'm talking about an actual grassroots political education about how to talk to people, what message you want to get across, and what do you want to have done. You can't just go to Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or any politician and say, black people are being disrespected in this country. What are you going to do about it? No, I mean, what do you expect them to say? They're part of the system that disrespects black people, and they want to continue to do those things. So, of course, they're going to look at you wild-eyed and make all those weird comments that Hillary Clinton made. You're not going to get anywhere with that. You have to first come up with an ideology. You have to sit down and make a very difficult choice that's going to lead to a lot of fighting and a lot of conflict in your organization to come up with an actual political ideology. What is our group? Are they Marxists? Are they liberals? Are they reformers? Are they revolutionaries? Are they soft? I mean, what are they?
Yeah, and specific demands.
And then after you come up with an ideology, then you come up with demands. But the only way you get demands is by talking to the people. So one of the things that I would like to see Black Lives Matter do more of after they come up with their ideology as an organization is to go out and knock on doors and come up with a strategy or come up with demands that come from the people. They should be talking to the people every day. Yes, I love the fact that they are going in and making the politicians talk about race. That's what we need to happen. We need them to continue to disrupt and do things like that. But you can't disrupt if you don't have a clear and tight ideology or message to give to the people and a clear strategy of how to get to where you want to get to. Because the same Black Lives Matter doesn't say anything about the end game.
Yes. They quoted here in this Black Agenda Report article, says Malcolm X liberated the black political conversation and set the stage for the most terminus productive era in the 20th century. Black U.S. history in 1963 when he railed against the Big Six, the Big Six civil rights organizations recognized by the elite power structure as representatives of black America. In other words, NAACP, Urban League, CORE, SCLC, SNCC, and A. Philip Randolph, off the black labor leader. Mm-hmm. He said both before and after the March of Washington, Malcolm accused the Big Six of collaborating with the Kennedys to cool down the passions of black people in the street. He said it was the grassroots out there in the street. Malcolm declares this message to the grassroots scared the power structure to death, and the job of the Big Six was to basically weaken and tame the movement. And he goes on to say that I think this is really good at the end of the article where he's saying Malcolm's accusations may have been unfair to some of the individuals and groups involved, but he did put the Big Six on notice that he would not respect the old dictum of not washing dirty linen in public and all that. I've heard that a couple times from my union leadership back in the day. As a result, self-employed black restraints on critiques of African-American leadership came tumbling down, and a raucous movement emerged to achieve black self-determination. And this is the last part I really like, is Malcolm turned the Big Six group's access to the White House into a source of righteous suspicion. And Malcolm was quoted as saying, why are you going in and out of the man's house? If you enter the man's house, you better tell the people what you talked about in there. Mm-hmm. And if you did, what did you promise them? And what is he offering you? And most important, you must understand that your presence in that house is by definition suspect.
And see, that's the thing with Malcolm, too, that and when you take a look at you look at Malcolm X, you look at the Black Panthers, you look at these 24 and 25-year-olds, Stokely Carmichael, H. Rap Brown, Huey P. Newton, these guys, every time they spoke, they had an objective and they had a message and they said what should happen and what they're going to do. No matter what, you always heard them saying these things. The Black Lives Matter leaders right now are around those same ages. They're a little bit older. They're like in their late 20s, early 30s. So they're older than the Black Panthers were when they started pushing their message. And when they talk, they don't talk about the end game. They don't talk about a strategy. They don't talk about an ideology of what they are trying to push other than recognizing that black lives need to matter in this country. What does that mean? And that is so critical to understanding how not only they can move forward, but how other groups can join in on the cause. Because otherwise, we're just sitting around posting things on Facebook, #BlackLivesMatter, but nobody knows what that means going forward, because police killings are even higher now than they were when the Black Lives Matter movement started.
Yeah.
And again, there's this critical piece of the political economy. They do not recognize material conditions as being the central focus of oppression in this country. That a lot of the issues that happen with the police happen in poor black neighborhoods, and that a lot of this stuff comes from poverty and looking at material conditions. They don't recognize that as being central because they haven't developed a clear message yet.
Okay.
And yeah, I would just want to add to your comments. I mean, just my particular take, for what it's worth, is that the liberals and Democrats will always, in circumstances like this, in times like this, they will always throw something at the black movement.
Crumbs.
As equal educational opportunity. Mm-hmm. They will always throw equal educational opportunity, and they will say, you should be satisfied with that. And I would say that among many things, perhaps, is what the Black Lives Matter movement would need is a firm critique, rejection, perhaps, of the notion that equal educational opportunity is central to what this movement is. Under the current circumstances, it can't possibly mean anything. It will always be a palliative, or will always be something to kind of silence people. What kind of education, as you referred to before, are you talking about, and what kind of system are people going into? So I would say, I mean, this is just a personal pet peeve of mine, but I think it's more than that. I think we really need to firmly start talking about what those words mean, and not to be lulled by those words and satisfied by those words, because that's what the Democratic politicians will try and do.
Okay, we're going to take a real quick music break. We will be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour, and we'll be back, Bill. Don't worry. So stay tuned.
Miller kept the Senior Citizen Center for a long time up there in Seattle, Washington. Jack had spent most of his life in the forest as a logger or timber beast, they called him in those days, because you were treated like an animal. There were no bunkhouses. He recalled sleeping on the ground with his fellow workers with their wet clothes from the rainforest piled in a heap next to the fire, hoping that they would be dry by the time to go to work the next day. Spoke many different languages in the forest, and they could hardly talk to each other. It was just like Lawrence. He said most of them had never been to school. Most of them couldn't read or write. Jack Miller could remember the Verona. There was a shingle weaver strike up at Everett, Washington. It was called the Everett Massacre. It's another one of those that didn't make it into the history books. The Wobblies, they chartered a steam launch called the Verona. And they had it sailed up there to Everett, bringing strike relief. And as the boat sailed into the pier, Sheriff McRae had ringed the whole pier with armed deputies. He just deputized every drunk in every bar in town and put a rifle in their hand. Well, they had surrounded the boat. And when they lowered the gangplank, Sheriff McRae walked to the end of it and said, "Who are your leaders here?" And they shouted back with one voice, "We are all leaders here." Well, that scared the tar out of the law, you know, and they began shooting. Those deputies began shooting. A lot of those Wobblies were killed. Some of the deputies were killed in the crossfire, though. So when the Wobblies, and those that survived, made it back to Seattle, they were arrested, and they were thrown in the Snohomish County Jail on a charge of murder, a whole bunch of them. Well, that jail was an all-steel jail. It was the newest affair, all made out of steel.
Okay, we're back at our World Labor Hour here. That was Utah Phillips, Whitecomb, about some direct action the IWW did back in Spokane, Washington, back in the 19-teens. That's another good song I thought I'd play for Labor Day, talking about direct action and solidarity. Real quick here, the threat from toxic dumping is not over. Community meeting on the Muhammad Aquifer is going to happen Saturday, September 19th from 10:30 to 12:30 at the Champaign Public Library. The Muhammad Aquifer is our community's sole source of water. Over 750,000 people in 14 counties in central Illinois rely on the Mahomet Aquifer for drinking, cleaning, etc. Despite recent victories over the past year, the Mahomet Aquifer is still under threat of contamination from toxic assets. The Clinton Landfill, owned by PDC Area Disposal, sits directly above the Mahomet Aquifer. Clinton Landfill has created a new kind of dump in order to receive toxic forms of waste. Clinton Landfill says they are willing to give up becoming a repository for toxic manufactured gas plant, NGP, and polychlorinated bienthal PCB waste, but now they are intent on becoming a landfill for other forms of toxic waste from a multi-state area, including coal ash and related waste. So please attend this community meeting to learn more and get involved to prevent this from happening. And that's Saturday, September 19th, 10:30 to 12:30, the Champaign Public Library. And real quick, the AFL-CIO Champaign County is going to host the annual Labor Day Parade on Monday, parade and picnic, and you can gather for that starting at 9 o'clock at Lincoln Square Mall. If you want to participate in the parade, Jobs with Justice number 41, place in the parade number 41 is open to anybody who wants to march. The parade will start at 10 going down Broadway and then east on Washington Street out to Prairie Park, in which there will be a picnic, free food and soft drinks, and everybody's welcome. And so that's Monday, starting at 10. And if you don't want to go to the parade, at least come as a spectator, cheer people on, and show up at the park for refreshments. There's also going to be some speakers and some kids, blow up, games and stuff like that. So tune out for that. Also, WFT WEF Fest 34 will be September 13th, 2000, from 5 to 10 p.m. at Mike and Molly's. Come help us celebrate our 34th birthday and turn out for that. So that's September 13th from 5 to 10. Okay, so, Bill, I'm sorry, we took a break. Oh, by the way, I'm opening up the phone lines. Anybody would like to call in at 217-359-5483 and 217-359-6545. Yes, the thought that you had in your mind when I had the news.
Well, now that the flow's been totally...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Actually, I was just going to say, they're talking about, the early Black Panthers, these different people, yeah, and the differences now between the groups. And I was just going to say, I read the books by Cleaver, Seal, Huey Newton, at least, and of course, Malcolm X's autobiography, and was totally impressed by their thinking. And I might not agree with everything, but I'm just really impressed with their ability to think. I see videos of them on the internet having these discussions. It just blows my mind how brilliant,
especially
they
how young they were,
right?
22-year-old.
Yeah,
right. And Malcolm X, I mean, he's like the political equivalent of Jimi Hendrix, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he went and he found some new things, and he was so articulate.
Yeah.
And you just don't, and generally, and see that.
And Fred Hampton. Don't forget Fred Hampton.
Fred, yeah.
How old was Fred Hampton when he was murdered by the Chicago police? 20
wow.
years old. He was already a leader in the community for at least two or three years.
Look at the musicians back then, too. I don't know what's happened. We just
Bruce.
Don't have any...
There were groups back then, remember?
Collaborating?
Everybody was collective back then. They were collaborators. Now everybody's an independent artist. But remember, back in the day, you had your band with you always in the recording contract. And even when you got into hip hop, you had at least one or two DJs that were in the group with you that didn't even rap, but they were just a group. So I think that's a major thing too, is that collective is
the
broken.
The loss of collectivism as an ethic,
yeah,
made mm-hmm. in our society. Definitely. Culture. Yeah, and that goes on to solidarity, the class consciousness, and how we're going to address it. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. That is a key here.
Is that a problem with our education system?
Well,
we keep hearing this dumbing down thing all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you think about with the advance of the internet and everything, you'd think that people would be a lot more politically organized and engaged. And I think just the opposite's happened in a lot of ways.
That's the thing, too. And one more thing I want to bring in. I think that's critical.
Go ahead.
But that's critical, though. I think that's a major problem because, you see, when the Panthers were doing this stuff, they were telling people, no, you have to go read these books. You have to go read. You have to have study groups.
They
you have to
schools.
Discuss. You have to have schools. You have to have meetings and talk about these things.
Yes.
This Facebook and Twitter and Instagram age, all they do is they do these little quick little list things and they put on posts. They're not told to read and to study and to like make that central to their movement. And Black Lives Matter is showing that.
Yes.
Yeah, you got to read about the movement before you do it.
He gave up.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, caller. If you want to call back, I had to let Gus finish that thought.
Yeah, that's huge, though. I mean, you know, just to kind of clarify what I'm saying is that, you know, these brothers, when they were talking and when any social movement group was talking, they were bringing up the history of it. They were bringing up the strategies of how these things work. You don't see that in Black Lives Matter when they talk. And I'm not saying this to totally just bomb on them or you know, talk bad about them. But they have a position right now to where they can do a lot of major good for people, not just in race, but in labor and gender and other things as well. So they should take this opportunity and progress as indeed. A group.
Indeed, indeed. Let's see here. Which line are they calling in on? The same one, perhaps? The other one. Okay. Hello, call. You're on the air.
Jim Iman, checking in.
Hi, Jim.
Hello, everybody. Two items. First one, Rafael Correa is in trouble in Ecuador.
Uh-huh.
And if he loses the coming election, it could mean curtains for Julian Assange in Britain.
Oh, yes. Okay. Uh-huh.
Okay. And second of all, I do think Gus is right here about Black Lives Matter. It reminds me a lot of the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of similarities.
A lot of similarities between Black Lives and Occupy. Bill was kind of, I guess, kind of hitting on that too earlier. Yes.
Right. So you have to have a spokesman that can talk to the press. You have to make demands, and even if you're putting your life on the line. And so there's a lot of similarities there. I just wanted to bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a great show, and I'll make room for Carol when she calls in.
Okay, Jim, thank you for the comment. I think that was very insightful and on the spot.
Okay.
Well, it reminds me of a comment you made a few weeks ago about the accountability aspect of this situation. If you don't have leaders, you don't have anybody, you know, to hold accountable for anything, or the leader to hold the rest of the people accountable.
Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, that's a good point. Angela, do you have anything to add to this or anything?
You know, and I think that, okay, all Black people, you know, they do matter, but I mean, this stuff has been going on since the beginning of time. So what actually can be done about it? Who do you go to? Who do you talk to? Because police are going to continue to kill Black people, and it's all this is going to continue to go on. So, I mean, what difference does it make whether we say this or that? I mean, what's going to change and who's going to change it?
Mm-hmm. Gus, did you want to respond to that?
The thing that's going to change it is, and we had these things happening, because when you had groups like the Panthers, or you have the Huey P. Newton Gun Club in Texas, what they were doing is they came up with a clear ideology and a clear program to push their neighborhoods forward. So you had the free breakfast program created in Oakland and other parts where the Black Panthers were that fed starving children and fed families. It worked so well that the federal government co-opted the program after the Panthers were disbanded. And now you have free and reduced lunch programs. So those types of things are successes, where that was a restructuring of the system, because now you have free and reduced lunch programs that is implemented into the United States government. And the same thing with police killings. When you have community and civil control of neighborhoods, you have less police killing. And when you have a group that goes in and forces a local government to make police officers live in the neighborhoods where they see people as subjects instead of objects, you have less shootings. I mean, those have been studies that have been done for over 100 years now. That works. But again, that goes into the process of disrupting the capital that can be made from bringing in people to live in other areas, though. So that's something that people have to really think about and think critically about when they build these ideologies about how to form social movements. And that's what Black Lives Matter can do. They have national and international attention at this point. I mean, it is that large. Use it, develop an ideology, and tell the people what you want and what you're going to do. And I'm telling you, it can really disrupt a lot of things.
When you say tell the people, you're talking about basically inform the public.
Inform the people.
Of what you want, the masses. Expect the ruling class to do.
Exactly.
But like you said earlier.
Issue demands.
That this basically has to be basically.
Exactly. You can't just say.
The people have to tell you. I mean, basically, the people you're trying to attract, you know, organize.
Exactly.
Have to tell you what they want, what they think, and then from there it flows up.
Exactly. That's okay. The thing. You have to be some type of constant communication with the community
you know, to actually create these types of social movements. And then the people are definitely going to tell them. That's how you know they haven't been talking to the people, because the people will tell them whenever you go to, when you knock on doors, they say jobs. They say the economic, the material conditions. You know, we need resources. People don't care about us. The distribution of wealth is disgusting. They tell you these things. Mm-hmm. That's why we're involved in the things we do. We need help.
Speaking of jobs, okay, black people made 25 cents an hour, what, about 50 years ago? And it's been about 50 years ago, and now it's only, we're only to 825. I mean, that didn't seem like nothing. I mean, 825 from all those years ago. I mean, from 25.
That's actually a major jump if you look at it from historical standpoint.
Well, but the thing is you know, you've seen some of the stats and stuff. Mm-hmm. If the minimum wage basically started, the minimum wage in 1969, if it would have kept up with inflation, would have been something like around $20 an hour now.
Yeah, definitely.
With productivity.
And then you would still have a surplus profit being made mm-hmm. by corporations. But again, that disrupts how capitalism works as a system, because it's no matter what, no matter how nice or not nice a capitalist group is, the point is to extract as much as possible. So by even denting that system, you're actually going against what capitalism is meant to do. And so again, it's all about that system aspect, that we can't look at it as being an individual issue. You know, like, oh, put this cop away, or make this corporation go away. No, because somebody is going to just replace them and continue the same practices. You have to go underneath the ground.
We need a self-confident labor working class movement in this country that really does understand that the people create the wealth of this country, mm-hmm. that the people who have all this wealth didn't work for it. It isn't a matter of let's go for them, let's go get it, and let's go ask for it. It's ours in the first place.
It's ours.
Okay, they stole it. Okay, I'm not saying they didn't do any work at all, but the vast majority of their wealth they stole through this financial means that we all know about, and we as little as we might understand about that, we know that they didn't work for that. But we have historical examples now. We need to emphasize, with all this historical research that's been done, just even recently, in understanding that the wealth of this country, it wasn't just the working people, it was the slaves of this country that established the northern wealth, mm-hmm. that we're all implicated in this. And so this is a historical process by which we really need to build the confidence of the working class that we're not taking what somebody else has, we're taking back what belongs to ours. And I would see blacks and the whole analysis of slavery and the wealth from the cotton empire that's been so foregrounded recently mm-hmm. to be part of that.
And again, I think that one of the things that has to happen, and I'm getting this from just having great conversations with Sundiata, which you know, it just really just makes a lot of sense, is that we have to step away from this fast paced, like short memory Facebook, Instagram type thing, you know, like actually go back to sharing articles, sharing documents, you know, like reading, creating study groups to have these discussions, having community forums to talk about these things, and not just posting hashtags on the internet, because it's not enough to just, it's just a zap. It's not enough for you to really develop how serious this human rights crisis is. And I think that's really one of the first part of the strategies that if I was in Black Lives Matter, one of the national organization, I would actually tell my local charters that one of the strategies that we're going to have is that you're going to have community meetings. You're going to go knock on doors, and you're going to invite people to tell you about what's going on with their lives and share them and give them a political education. Like, have these meetings once a week, once a month, something like that. That's a strategy. And again, I agree with you, Angela, that it's very difficult to see something positive coming from this, but that's only because the examples that we have currently have not used the historical examples of groups like the Black Panthers or working
class. That's history they're trying to bury.
Doors and actually talk to people and not sit around in bars downtown or places on campus. Maybe put flyers in barber shops and laundromats.
Yeah, exactly. What a concept,
not
huh?
Just in the trendy downtown bistros.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think knocking on doors is important. And the thing is, though, it's a lot of work.
It is.
It's a lot of time. It's a, and you got to make it effective. You got to organize a fair number of people to do it. And but it's the most effective way of organizing that one on one, face to face.
And another thing too is that it's a lot of work to come up with an ideology that you can stick to, because you have so many different personalities that come into an organization, and you're going to have a nasty, sometimes physical, but mostly emotional and, you know, figurative fight about what is our group going to stand for. Some people may stay, some people may leave, but you have to have that conflict and make it very complicated before you can create some type of movement.
And
I'm sure, and I know the history of the Green Party. There was a lot of stuff that went into you are creating that list of demands that everybody was not, that was not happy with at first. But that goes with any social movement, and taking that infra-politics I talked about at the beginning of the show and making it into an actual objective that can be moved forward. That's what would scare the crap out of the Democratic Party the most, is if they actually gave Hillary Clinton a list of demands with the data to prove their point and tell her what they have to do. For the rest of the election, she and Bernie Sanders would have to answer to those demands. But it wasn't clear when they gave it to her. So that's what would change it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'd be doing another Ferguson too.
Well,
they didn't even do that. They didn't even do that then. That was more. I mean, it was a plan. It was a planned rebellion, but it still wasn't to the point to where there was an actual demand, a list of demands that was set up by Black Lives Matter. That's the whole point, is that since their inception, they haven't created something that could lead to a progressive social movement, and that what they're doing is they're raising consciousness, and they're causing infra-political angry behavior to manifest, but it's not evolving, is the point. It's stuck in break right now. It's not evolving yet.
Well, more people need to get involved, is what it is. I mean, a lot of people, they care and they want to do this, they say that, but they're not actually doing anything. They're not, you know, they just not involved. And so we may want this, but I mean, if you're not involved, then I mean, we're not going to see any, you know, we're not going to see anything happen.
But let's be honest, if you want a social movement to move forward, like I said, the one thing that you have to do, if you don't do it, is going to collapse, which we saw with Occupy, is knock on doors. You have to ask the community and the people what they want. There's power in the consciousness of the people to demand the things that they want. And if you don't do that, then people are not going to have an invested interest or relationship with the movement. But that comes from the vanguard, or which I don't like to use that term, of the Black Lives Matter. They're going to have to knock on doors, and they're going to have to, like you say, do a lot of hard work to build this movement to something that's actually strong. Because right now it is superficially strong. But when in terms of like stakes and like this actually turning into something that could change the country, I don't see it right now until they actually strengthen themselves.
You know, I had the Bill and I both had the I don't know, now that we're in our late 50s, maybe we're not so lucky, but the fact that we grew up during the 60s and saw it from a distance.
I wish I would have been born 10 or 20 years earlier.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, we saw how things can be organized.
You wouldn't want that.
Yeah, David, you're a little...
I'll have to be like you someday anyway.
Yeah.
I was kind of hoping to avoid, you know, the collapse of civilization and the ecology, but I don't...
But no, I'm saying, David, too, I mean, you grew up in L.A., right? You're a little bit older than me and Bill, so I mean, we lived through and saw what how this country.
I really wasn't part of that, but I could make up stuff if you want. But you know, I was basically just kind of a quiet kid going to school. So
I wanted to bring something up though, Dave.
Yeah,
a lot of these things that we're talking about, a little bit about canvassing, and I think somebody brought up the school lunch program, low cost lunch programs for inspired by the
Which,
Black Panthers.
Which, by the way, is what J. Edgar Hoover found the most threatening about the Black Panthers was the community pre-lunch program for kids. I mean, that was revealed in some of his memoirs after he's dead, which blew me away.
Okay.
You know?
But anyway, like one of the the ethics, you might say, or tendencies of the sort of the leftist side is for social movement action through the government.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You see, so what happened well, not so much top down, but instead of us building our own things.
Mm-hmm.
That people appreciated us for, we got the government to do it. Okay. Meanwhile, you have mega churches who are supplying these services to members.
even to the level of motorcycle clubs and dating, you know, much less more basic things. And that they have that influence because of that. It's sort of like there was, I don't know, you probably saw the big aware kerfluffle this week on email, the anti-war, anti-racist education. And somebody was talking about, well, we're not doing much anti-racist stuff. And but, of course, that was established, you know, for Muslims and Arabs, you know, dealing with war. Sorry, folks, it's local inside baseball. But this kind of idea came up, and, you know, and my comment on it was, we needed a revolution, and we got affirmative action. You see? Because, and what that did there, that set many people against, in the working class against each other, right or wrong. It was perceived very bad. Everybody knows this by many white male workers. And helped set us against our brothers and sisters. But somebody else said, well, and I'm not totally anti-reform, somebody else said, well, you know, now these people have a better chance, you know, minorities, women. I said, and that's is one good, you know, but we really needed the more overall thing.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. I mean, I've seen how that play out. I mean, the thing is that if there was, hadn't been affirmative action, we wouldn't. I mean, and the numbers are still horribly low in the building trades of African-American tradesmen compared to the percentage of the population here in Champaign-Urbana, which is where 99% of the work takes place in Champaign County.
I think there's fewer women now than there was in
there
the
80s. There are. I remember there used to be at least one or two female tradesmen or apprentices, and I don't see hardly any women unless they work at the U of I in the trades, and they're all like in their 50s now, you know. Absolutely. You know, the thing is, if it wasn't for affirmative action, that wouldn't have happened. But on the other hand, I know exactly what you're saying about how that's used to play white workers off against black workers.
Yeah, the only reason I don't know what the original intent was, but that's how a lot of things worked out, and that didn't help. But we just, you know, and it takes the fuel out of the revolution. It takes the motivation of some people, well, we've got affirmative action now, so we don't need to go further and take more, and the system's all right, see, it corrects itself, that sort of thing also.
Yeah.
I know, well, David, when I was speaking before, you were writing me a note. And
actually,
I didn't look.
Our silent partner wrote that.
Oh, okay. Well, whoever it was, Michael is his name?
No, he doesn't want his name published. He's Mr. X.
Oh, Mr. X. He says...
Worker X.
And I
Worker X, you know, okay.
Agree with this. He said, I keep saying it. The way to go is guaranteeing annual income automatically wipes out poverty, also called negative income tax.
And then you don't have people being jealous of people on welfare.
Yeah.
Like all these people, one common meme, at least I could get to meet the welfare family I'm supporting, you know...
Look, I
hear this stuff, man.
Bill's being ironic, just for you listeners that don't know Bill. I mean, he's...
I'm just saying what people say to me.
Yeah. But, David, you're thinking that it's called a negative income tax, where basically everyone's guaranteed a
Richard
minimum
Nixon liked it.
Annual income.
Yeah.
Yeah, but why did he like it, though? That's the thing.
And Martin Luther King liked it.
Richard Nixon liked it because he was trying to grasp for something to, you know... Because you think about it, the time, everything, there was literally in the 60s, there was revolution in the street, you know, and Nixon was forced to even say something like that, you know.
Well, that's how come you can get things in like affirmative action and so on and so forth, because the revolution is in the street, you know, and they don't want to have that happen.
Yes.
And look how it perfectly set it up for the Lewis Powell-inspired backlash.
The Powell Memo? 1971 Powell Memo.
It set up an automatic backlash of people being favored over other people, and trees being favored over people, and spotted owls being favored over white men.
Now, Bill's being sarcastic here, just so you know. He doesn't really believe this stuff. This is irony, okay? Just so you listeners know that. Yeah.
But again, the idea of the annual guaranteed income reinforces the idea that the productive means of the society belong to the people, that we have a right to the basic level of income and standard of living because we produce that. Okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter on the individual level what we do and what, you know, we are doing that, and that should be fundamental to Labor Day weekend.
Exactly. We own our own production. I mean, that's the basic necessity or human right, I believe, should be the center of the movements, is that we own our own production.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that will totally dismantle the distribution of wealth that's currently today.
Right.
That would lead to a lot of issues. Also, the two-party system. Yeah. It would also fix a lot of the other issues in terms of the political economy of this country.
Right. Yeah, now, David, I just participated with you in a weekly reading of Thomas Piketty's book, Capital.
Yeah.
And both of us had some differences with Piketty. But one thing that really impressed was he come up with some really interesting, profound information. I mean, especially about wealth and about the people who have it. And, do you want to maybe share some thoughts on that?
I mean, I think the basic thing to understand is that for people to understand what the difference is between income and wealth, what is really useful, how it is that in a rich country, the working people, what's actually produced doesn't satisfy the basic needs of the working families, and how that happens, how wealth in a sense stifles income, how stocks in a sense stifle flows, how we become this big bloated wealth owning machine that doesn't provide the basics, even though it's all there for that to actually happen. And again, it just gets back to the basic idea of private property and accumulation of wealth, and how we are in a cycle now. What the book talks about is we are in a cycle now where we're back to where we were 100 years ago in terms of the accumulation of wealth by a small group of people who, again, didn't really work for that wealth. They do it by renting. They do it by a rate of return
and
on
violence.
Their wealth instead of labor.
Yeah.
And how all those cycles have worked
over the last 30, 40 years. This basically this huge amount of wealth belonging to just a small number of people at the very top. It's not just the 1%. The truly wealthy in this country, the ones that really control this country, are 0.1%. Basically, I think, what did he say? It was down to 40,000 people in this country in the 1%, roughly. Mm-hmm. And we've got 300 million people. And but the thing is that this is not about jealousy about they got money and I don't. This is the fact, when you've got too few people having too much money, it harms the economy for everybody.
It's just not the economy.
It's the environment, democracy, and democracy. Yes,
because it's not one person, one vote. It's a dollar a vote.
That's exactly what we have in this country
now. I'm going to tell you right now. I've said this over and over and over, and we've touched on it here. One conversation is worth 10,000 political TV commercials.
Well, that's true. That's very true. Okay, let's see here. We're going to take, a quick music break, and we're almost out of time. We're going to come back and kind of wrap things up. So you listen to the World Labor Hour on the Supporting Community Radio Station, WT in Champaign. Stay tuned.
There comes a time when the operation of the machine is so odious that you cannot even tacitly participate. You've got to place your bodies on the gears, the wheels, all the mechanism, and you've got to indicate to those who own it and those who run it that unless you are free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. The new ruling party is holding the aces. The rest of the cards are all missing faces. I'm sorry I can't know you today. What can one say? I will not obey. Give us your sons and give us your daughters. No one is safe or immune from the slaughter. How indifference makes them rage. What can one say? I will not obey.
Okay, that's a few little things from Utah Phillips. Sorry about that. So just to kind of wrap things up a little bit here, last words, let's go counterclockwise to the left. David, we'll start with you.
Well, if you want to get involved in the Green Party, you can email me, David Green, or David Johnson, or prairiegreensil@gmail.com, and you can help us move forward in that, and happy Labor Day.
Okay, Angela.
Happy Labor Day to the people also. And I just encourage people to get more involved. If we want, you know, action to be taken, we need, everybody needs to get involved and be serious and just take it really seriously.
Okay, Bill?
If you go to one of the local county market grocery stores, when you're checking out, ask the person checking you out wearing the pin that says employee owned.
Oh, yeah.
Ask them if they get to vote on what their wages are.
Yeah, difference between employee owned when they have a few percent of the stock as opposed to employee managed and owned.
But you can always, no matter where you're at, strike up a decent conversation with the person behind the counter. It's something I do quite a bit.
Okay.
They think I'm nuts, but they learn something.
Yeah, okay. Gus?
Yeah. Hope everybody has a great weekend. No, I'm not taking Dave's word, but really we need to really say this as much as possible, but power to the people.
Okay.
Seriously, I mean, it's critical at this point.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so, you know, I guess just to wrap things up a little bit here, I want to just say thank you for tuning in. And, you know, every day or every year this comes around at this time, I'm always trying to think of, you know, what would be some good topics to talk about. We've done history of Labor Day before. You know, it gets a little complicated. But the main thing to remember is, you know, Labor Day, like May Day, were movements for the 8-hour workday. Because you got to understand something. If it wasn't for working people organizing and forming unions, we wouldn't have the weekend, we wouldn't have holidays, we wouldn't have at least the somewhat pay we've got.
We wouldn't have Labor Day.
We definitely wouldn't have Labor Day, yeah, but these were movements to fight for the 8-hour day, and believe me, this just wasn't given to us out of the kindness of the hearts of the ruling class in this country. People died for this stuff. You got to understand that. People were beaten, jailed, tortured, and killed and murdered by the powers that be and their armed mercenaries. And you got to remember that. This stuff was all fought for. Nothing in the history of the world, and especially not in the history of the United States, has ever improved for the better without a fight.
We need September should be Labor History Month.
Yeah, it should be, actually. You're right. Okay, we're going to leave you with a little, let's see, who do we have here? Oh, Tom Morello. Everyone have a happy Labor Day, and we'll see you next week. Take care.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. Poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bone. A man that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older, deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, as I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. Loaded 16 tons of number 9 coal. And the straw boss said, well, bless my soul. 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, as I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. A fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Ain't no boss man alive, make me walk the line. I load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron and the other steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, as I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
the company store. To the company store.